And we're ready to make loans, you know. And we made many mistakes because we didn't know. It was weird, so obviously. First, we made an announcement that we had money to loan, you know. The next day, there were about 50 farm workers waiting for the office to open because they wanted their loans, you know.
Oh.
And so we started, we came in, we didn't, no collateral, nothing, you know. And then no credit check, nothing. It was just like, yeah, you need 50 bucks, okay, sign here, like that, you know. We thought we were doing the right things. This guy came in and said, I need 50 bucks because, you know, this and that, you know, whatever the reason was. You know. And I'd look at Caesar, we're kind of, we're the loan officers and everything, you know. So. And so he'd look at him and I says, yeah, he looks okay, you know. Looked at him on his face, and it was a farm worker, you know. So all the farm workers had on his faces, you know. So. And so we made loans, and before you know, we had loaned out the money, you know. It's no more, it's you know. And needless to say, we made some real bad loans. And some people didn't pay their loans, and I don't know. But anyway, yeah, in spite of that, we survived, you know. The reason I kind of like to tell the story is because it's a success story, really. That's what it was, you know. We knew it was a service that needed to be done, you know, because people really, you know. Now we make jokes out of it. We call them face loans. Those first we made face loans because just look at the face, and that was the collateral. And we looked at it, it's just yeah. So we nodded, yeah, okay. And he said the other one, said, yeah, looks okay. So we made those loans, but obviously they weren't very good loans. Some paid back, others didn't. You know, most of them didn't. So anyway, the thing, the upshot of the story is that. Even with all those bad things that happened, it didn't. The credit union continued. It didn't die, you know. Okay. Then we had to. In fact, the lawyer was one of the collectors. He'd go to the house and to the house of the guys that owed the money. Says, you know what? You have to pay your you know. You get your $15 loan. You know, every month. You know, and said, but gigs, we don't have any. Sometimes he'd go and open the door, and they'd close the door, and she'd go around. I says, the lawyer would go around the house and come through the window and say, where's my money?
Oh.
She was a collector, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then, so we had a, it's funny now, but it's funny, but it wasn't so funny then, you know. And then we had my compadre, Julio Hernandez, was like, he was a tough guy, you know. César, he said, put me in charge of your boy, let's win la madre si no nos pagan.
Uh-huh.
I said, no, remember, non-violence, Julio, we can't do that, you know. So anyway, everybody came up with ideas how to collect the money. Anyway, in spite of everything, we survived, you know. And then the credit union years later, you know, became very successful, but it was run like a bank, you know, collateral, you know, it was run by professionals. We were professionals, so we screwed it up, you know. And the thing is that until we merged, just last year we merged with Kern Central, the Farmers Credit Union, we merged with the Kern Central now, you know, that's one. And so up to that point we had loaned in services, look how much service provided. $33 million had been loaned in that since 1964 until the time that we merged. Just imagine all the service that was provided, you know. A lot of service, you know. And now the credit union loans for new cars and, you know, down payments on houses, big time, and it's a big thing now, you know. And we have a deduction, you know, where they can automatically put so much in the credit union, or they can pay their out of the checks, they deduct and make the payment. You know, it's all just like the bank now, you know, just like it's professional. It's a credit union. Very professional now. It's like, you know, we don't even have to worry about it. You know, it's going well. We built it, it's part of another credit union. So it's the thing is that it was a success story because we provided a lot of. Even all through the trials and tribulations
what
and everything.
Happened to the house?
I got paid, but years later, much, much later.
Oh.
In little bits, you know, like 50 now and 100 then. I got paid, you know, my loan got paid, but not until years later, didn't it? And so, anyway, that's a credit union story, but it was a success, you know. It's another one of Cesar's ideas that had, it was a success story, you know, so. And many other things that he thought of, you know. So
just because we're talking about the cutting, and I know you have a lot of different levels of supporters. You have the members, and what is it? Associate membership. So all of those people qualify for the cutting.
All of those qualify.
You've done a really good job there.
Yeah. Even the associate members even qualify for insurances in Mexico. Like, you know, they pay so much, and then their family is insured in Mexico. They have family in Mexico. They can provide services way out in the interior, anywhere that, in fact, we have a contract with Mexicano Seguro Social, M-I-S-S?
IMSA.
IMSA.
I-M-I-M-A-S-S.
I-S-S. IMSA.
I-S.
Okay, it's in Mexico.
I-S-A.
Yeah. It's a Mexican.
IMISSA is what it is.
It's the only foreign outfit that has a contract with the Mexican government to provide that kind of service. And that's provided only through the associate membership. Now, where we have membership, it's different, you know. I mean, we have, it's another.
So IMSA started off by the United Farm Workers?
No, that's Mexico's Social Security system.
We contracted with them so we could provide services for the people in the rural areas in Mexico and where we live. You know, there's always an IMSA.
For the dependents of the workers here?
Yes. And now, just about 2 weeks ago, I was in Michoacán. We went to Michoacán. Now we're because a lot of strawberry workers are from Michoacán.
Yeah, that's
okay.
True.
And so we went to talk. We met with the governor of Michoacán, and they're going to start a pilot project where we're going to contract with the state of Michoacán for the ones under contract. Okay. So they have their clinics all over the state, and they will provide services. We're going to contract, pay so much to the state government to provide services. Because right now, see, when the workers come, they've got medical assistance here, but there's no way we can do that in Mexico, because, you know, there's no way, you know. We do it along the border towns because it's close by. We can control that. Like we're in Tijuana, Mexicali, in Santa Rio, Colorado. We provide services to those families there, but the ones that live in the interior, there's no way we could do it. But we could do it if somebody else provides the service and they charge us for it, you know. We provide the service through a contract. We pay so much, so much per worker, whatever. So they can provide the service. And we're looking in other words, we have a pilot project that we're going to put out and see if it works. And in a small scale, if it works, then it's going to be off.
From the credit union in your house?
This is not the credit union. This is the contract. This is the contract part of the union.
You know, my family's from Michoacán, and I know all of my family has worked in La Fresa, mm-hmm. and I've been reading a lot of the Purépecha Indians are strawberry workers, you know, so.
What part of Michoacán?
Zamora?
Ahí cerca de Curandiro, but I've traveled throughout Michoacán. Where did you go?
Oh, I went to to Zamora.
Morelia?
To Morelia. Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, it's a beautiful place, Morelia. And then to small communities, La Piedad, and, you know, Churincio, Tangancícuaro. We went to Bocaneo, and we went to Jacona, and, you know, all those places. Yeah.
So what year was
Credit Union? Credit Union was founded in 1964. Either 3 or 4.
Oh, that's early.
Yeah. That's one of the first services we had. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It was still a service. Remember talking about the service, Annie? That was the service that we provided. Yeah. Then the benefits. That's the others are called benefits. They came with a union contract, like the pension, the vacations.
First contract?
Was the Chenley contract, the one I talked about during the March of 1966.
You know, I know that there was a lot of, when we're talking about the strike, there was a lot of divisions between, I guess, the farm workers who were supporting, you know, the United Farm Workers, and then, you know, the Mexicanos that were just coming in that didn't know about what was going on, and they were just working. Remember how you stated that they would strike one day, but then they would get a whole new set of people, and then, there was a division amongst the Mexicanos and the Mexicanos amongst themselves. How did you guys ever settle that division, or
Well, it wasn't a planned division. It's because people come here to work, you know. And a lot of times they would lie to them. They didn't say there's a strike going on. They just go to the border and they say, quieren trabajar, muchachos. Nobody wants to work, so they'd fill up the buses and bring them in. And they'd come in here and they'd see this picket line. They didn't know what was happening, you know. So, but they'd last there 2 or 3 days and then we'd organize them or they'd leave and go some other place, you know. It wasn't like, you know, it was. And some people, I'm not saying that everybody went to a strike. Other people just broke the strike because they were scabs. They didn't care. They wanted to break the strike. They wanted to work, you know. They didn't care who was suffering or who was what they were fighting for, you know. And so I come here to work and I'm going to work, you know. And those are the guys that would be called scabs or quebrahuelgas, you know. Yeah. But, you know.
So did you find that if you could educate those workers from the
Oh, right. Yes. We pull a lot of mud, you know, you know. They work 2 or 3 days and it's, pues déjenme hacer nomás, déjenme trabajar 2 días para sacar, para darle más para el norte. Okay, work 2 days and then they go, you know. Yeah, no, no, esa conveniencia de los dos lados, you know, sí. Oh, no, yeah. No, people see. Even up to date right now, even up to date, you know, I'd be lying if I tell you everybody was 100% for the union, you know. I mean, you know, for X reasons, you know, some are family to the guy, to the boss, you know. So naturally they're going to support him, you know, stay in work, you know. But they all understand that the union is a good thing. That's they all understand that it's a good thing, you know. Some have trouble supporting it because, you know, they need to work for whatever reasons they have, you know. But, you know, once you explain to them everything, you know, they see, we've never had any trouble winning elections. You know, it's never been a problem winning elections. We got there and organizing winning elections. Our problem was Wilson, these guys that they made a mockery out of the law, the farm worker law, you know. They just didn't enforce it. It wasn't enforced, you know. So you have a law, but it does not enforce. What good does it do, you know?
Yeah. Well, speaking of elections, were you part of any of the
Georgia election? Oh, yes, sure. Even Luis, you know, Luis, from Puerto Campesino, Luis.
Valdez,
and all those, Danny and Luis, they were all in the picket line. They were picketers, you know. That's where Puerto Campesino started, you know. You know, they were all in the Georgia, involved in that. They were a big part of the Georgia campaign. Yeah. It's the early days.
What was yours?
Strike leader, you know, like, because you're picking in different.
Strike leader means. Okay. Just tell us one day of a strike leader's, in a life of a strike leader.
Okay. Say, for example, an example. Say this is a company, pretty good sized company. All the workers are not working in this field here, you know. There's some workers, some crews working here, you know, 5, 6 crews, whatever, you know. It's a big ranch, you know. So we're talking about growers that have thousands of acres here, you know. And then there's another crew working in a few miles away, and another, again, another 5 or 6 crews working here, and another 5, 6 crews working. They're not all working, you know, within 10 miles, you know, 10, 12, 20 miles, whatever, you know, because they have land all over the place. And so you take picket lines. So picket line 1 is going to go to X ranch today, you know, streets, you know, in streets, a corner, so and so street, you know. Everybody knows a map, you know. And so I take my crew, says, okay, we get up at 3:30 in the morning, 4 o'clock, get ready, get breakfast, get ready, get our picket signs, get instructions what we're going to do, you know, where we're going to go. And they say, okay, you go today, you go here, you know. And so, and okay, guys, let's go. We get in the cars and make a formal line, you know. And so we'd go out there, go out there before the workers get there. We'd be there by 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30. The worker starts coming in, you know. As they start coming in, we start talking to them. Miren, muchachos, aquí hay una huelga, okay, you know. And then you start organizing, that's what it is, you know. And then if they cross the line and start working, then you stay there, you know, talking to them on the bullhorn, you know, with a loudspeaker. Miren, muchachos, lo que no más es una cosa buena, es un bien para todos, tienen que comprender que no nomás miren lo, aquí miren el futuro, sus familias, and, you know, organizing, you know, talking all day long, you know, talking, trying to convince them, you know. It'd be surprising to pull out a lot of people because it's just the way you talk to them, you know. And so that's a typical day.
During this time, how big would one crew be? I'm just picturing, because I know the ranches here are just huge, and there's really no fences, and how would you communicate where the picket line should go? Or, you know,
And so,
anyway, what I'm saying is, it just seems awfully vast, and you know, I'm trying to get to organization.
Yeah. Well, most crews consist of about 120 people. Okay. You know, anywhere from 80 to 120. A smaller crew might be 60, but you know, mostly it's 80 to 100, 150, 120. That's a good size, great crew. That works together, and another 120 here, another 120, 80 over there in a smaller piece, you know, they're different sizes, you know. But usually that's one foreman can take care of as many people with his assistant.
So how would you
fork
it, how would you know where to put your
pick? We know where they're picking, you know what has to, we already know what has been picked and what's going to be picked next. We know the whole area. We know every single wrench, every single road, every single corner, you know, every stop sign. See, this, we know this already.
See, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
I mean, but you knew the work already.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been just any outsider coming in trying to organize because they would have known this.
A lot of, we have people working inside, we call them submarines, okay? Our people, we let them work in there so we could know what's happening. That's a tactic, you know? Submarines. So we say, okay, they would tell them in the evening, we say, okay, tell them where are we going to go. And so he'd call us at night, says, we're going to be at a certain place tomorrow morning. So, you know, and that's the way it happens. Thank you, Charlie. And, you know.
Yeah, I mean, because I know other people have tried to organize farm workers, and when they come from outside, they don't know.
No. You have to know the area. We know every single, like I said, every single block of grape, what kind of grape is grown there, you know, so we know what's going to be. Okay? See, there's 120 varieties of grapes, you know. Okay? And you have to know every variety where it is, you know. So they're picking the early grape, which is the early one, is what they call the very first one that they pick in Coachella is a perlet. It's the first one that comes, that's ready to be picked. You know. And the last grape that's ready to be picked would be in October. So you see, from May to October, you will know which varieties are coming to. Then the Thompson, then the Lady Fingers, and on and on. You know. The red flames and this and that, you know. So we know. Yeah. See, we know all that. Yeah, that's already. We know all that stuff. We do research, tons of research, and we know everything. You know. So it's not no guesswork when it comes to that. We already know, you know, everybody.
Well, that's what
we. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's already an organization. We already know exactly what's happening. Yeah.
Did you ever participate in a fast?
I fasted once, more than once, but my longest fast was 11 days, and this was in front of a store in Long Island. We were having trouble getting this store to cooperate, you know, and so we decided we were going to fast, you know. So I fasted in front of the store for 11 days.
You were alone?
Huh?
You were alone?
Yeah.
Fasting?
That's my longest fast.
What year was it?
Must have been in 73.
Because of your fast, did it become successful with this store in Long Island?
Yes, you got it.
Was it to for them to stop buying, selling grapes?
Yes.
Is that what it is?
Yes. Yeah. See, we've got all kinds of agreements. You know, once, and this is, it's almost incredible. You know, a lot of like the boycott stories that I tell you has never been written about. It's almost like if somebody would tell me that and I wasn't there, I said, come on, you know, it didn't happen, you know. Sometimes we got agreements with the stores to let us pick it inside the store, you know, at the great sense. We can't take them out, but if you guys, instead of picking outside, why don't you send two or three guys in there, right in front of the, right inside the store with your signs, and when the people come to talk to them right there, you know, so, but don't disturb my people coming into the store, you know.
So let them shop, but not for
grapes. Yes, they would let us go there. It's like, shooting like fish in a barrel, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you say, lady, you know what this is? You know, this is, you know, and then we start the whole spiel, you know, and then like, I didn't know that, oh my God, no, I won't touch them, I'll take some bananas or something else, you know, and with the grape would just stay there, you know, nobody would, right inside the store, they got us pick up these big supermarkets, you know. It's amazing, you know, the things that happen, you wouldn't believe it. You know? It's just like the boycott is just one big story. You know? So,
Since we're mentioning hometowns, I am from Oxnard. Did you ever organize in Oxnard?
No, I didn't. I went to school there.
Oh, yeah?
A la Católica.
Oh, Puerto Rico?
Yeah. Yeah. Barbara West? Ramona's new. Well, there was new. There was. They weren't there yet. Ramona and the only thing was Barbara Worth and another one. Person. Yeah, Oxnard was only when we lived there. Only was 4,500. You know. Yes, I know. I've been there. Yes. So anyway. Yeah. She was in charge, because when you're a boycott coordinator in a certain area, like, let me first explain to you what, I was doing New York, okay? So it wasn't only New York City. I had Long Island, and I had Connecticut, and I had Jersey, okay? I mean, that's what they call the greater New York, the metropolitan New York area. That's what it is, really, you know? And it's all one mess, and so was the same. It's the same, and it's a different state, but it's part of New York, really. Really, it's what it is, you know. And so I had somebody in Westchester County, or that's an area. Westchester County was a big area, so I had a boycott coordinator over there. I had somebody in across the Hudson, that little place I was telling you that the cop did this to me. And then I had somebody in Patterson, in New Jersey, in Patterson and Maspaka Patterson, constantly in New York, that area. It's all one big area. It's all big area, you know. And then I had people in Long Island. There were two people in Long Island. It's a very big place. So I had one in the tip, what we call a tip, and then one close to Queens, you know. And then I had one in Queens, one in Brooklyn, one in the Bronx, and one in two in Manhattan. And then I had some in Connecticut, you know, Connecticut. So it was a big operation, huh? Okay, so esta muchacha, I forget her name right now, she said, Richard, we're having trouble with this, because they have this chain store, and I think it's World Bombs. And she says, I'm having trouble, they won't budge, you know, we picket it, and we've been picketing hard, but they won't budge anything, you know, it just won't let up, you know. And I says, we have to do something different. And I says, well, what can we do? And so we did this, we did that. He says, maybe you should fast in front of the store, you know, to get more people, you know, more people's attention. That's news, you know. I mean, every night in the news, you know, people have to know about it, that you're fasting and you're on your sixth day or seventh day, you know, and people start following like an OJ thing, you know. It's a bad comparison, but, you know, you know, people want to know what's happening, you know. And so... I've never done it before. I've guessed it through 3 days, you know. But I've never, how long. Well, let's play it by ear, you know. Let's not say I'm going to fast for 3 weeks and then like that. Let's just play it by ear, see how, you know. Because I don't know, you know, what I'm going to feel, you know. And then if I'm still feeling bad and I go see the doctor has to examine me, he says you better stop, but then I will, you know, whatever, you know. But I'll go as long as I can. So it was, you know, we made some publicity and we were going to start fasting, you know, right there in front of the store, you know, right there. And I sat down there, got my little cojincito, and that's there, you know, just water fast, you know. And so people started responding because they saw me there not eating, you know, you're not eating, you know, because the farm workers are suffering a lot in California, and this is the least I could do, you know. And so, oh my God, I'm not going to shop here anymore. There's another store I can go to, you know, that sort of thing. That's how it happens, you know. And so it worked, you know? It worked, you know. Got a lot of publicity, and because of the publicity, people started not going to that store. And when they see they start losing their sales, I mean, they respond to it just like that, you know. Because their margin, I understand, is so, their margin is so, so, it's just not a big margin. Like you can't lose customers because then it affects your overall. The margin's not that big in supermarket. And so anyway, I did it and it worked, you know. So you know. But that's
so
the only time.
Oh, yeah,
he would examine me. No, he would examine me. No, you're doing okay, Rich. You know, you test my acid and my uric acid and all that. So finally set up my 11th day. He said, you know, how do you feel? I said, yeah, you know, a little lightheaded today. He says, well, says, you know, I think we better start thinking. That was about the 9th, 10th day. He says, I think you better start thinking about another day or two at the most. You know, so I says, it's okay. 11th day.
So you don't have any long-term damage from that?
I'm a diabetic. I don't have anything to do with it, but no, it really doesn't. Well, not unless you overdo it, you know, and then you start getting into problems. But it's not 11 days is not. Yeah. That was my fasting experience. And I've done other fasts, you know, like for my own, you know, like not for anything else, just I want to do. Not eat for 3 days, I could cleanse, you know, and all that. And that's a good health reason. So.
That's part of the house.
Yeah. For a reason, that was the one. Yeah.
On your speaking tours, how were they organized? Were they specifically for fundraising or education, information? Did you divide them up?
Both. There's two types. Yeah, well, you're right. When it's fundraising, we get somebody, a committee at the college, university, whatever, and they set it up. And there's an honorarium involved. Okay, this is when it's fundraising. They set it up for you, and you know they tell you when it's going to be and what they would like to hear about, you know, what I'm going to speak about. And you go up there and make your presentation, and they pay you money to do it. You know? That's the fundraising. And then you talk about the movement, you know, the farm workers' struggle, you know. And most of the times it's you do both, you know, because it's what they want to hear in the first place. And when it's informational, but you know, like I made a tour, when was it? It's almost 2 years now. It's going to be 2 years later in the summer. I spoke at 10 colleges and universities in the Boston area. Yeah, I did that in about 3 or 4 days. And this was, we were doing a pesticide thing, okay? About the poisons in the grapes and the cancer clusters here in the valley, the kids dying from cancer and all that, you know. And they also set them up. Our committee sets them up, you know. Our committee, like the committee in Boston, set that up, you know. You know, they set it up. I was going to go speak about pesticides and the dangers of pesticides. That was a topic. And then I go out there and make my presentation about the dangers and how farm workers get poisoned daily on a daily basis, how they're not careful, you know, how we've been able to ban some, but they come up with different brands and different names, and it's the same pesticide, you know, under the same roof, you know, and these guys, you know, and you know, about the cancer clusters, the children dying in the area. And another consumer that they didn't know, but now the consumer, you know, he might know, but he doesn't wash them. It's the same pesticides that we get personally eating when you buy the grapes or the berries or whatever, you know. You put it all in one package, you know. And it's an informational thing, you know. In fact, I was telling John just before we came, we were talking about it, what I was telling. I spoke at Harvard. In MIT, also in Boston University, and all those, I don't remember, all the big ones, I think. But at Harvard, it was really interesting because I spoke to professors there. I mean, this is a room full of professors, and some students too, but, you know. But I knew my material. I prepared well for that, you know. I just knew my material, and I could give references where they could check this out and who said it, what time, who made the research, and all that kind of thing, you know. And they think that you're really smart, but it's not that. You just know your material, just present it, you know. And then they ask questions, and you answer intelligently, you know, because you already researched. You know what you're talking about, you know. That's it. So it's not like. At first, I used to get nervous. Yeah, you know.
Do you remember your first speech?
Big speech, no. I remember my first little speech.
Oh, yeah, okay.
What was it? This was in the days of when the strike. Yeah, just at the very beginning of the strike. Remember when the strike in 1965? I had told Caesar, that's when he came and said, are you going to come and work full time with me? I said, Caesar, look, Caesar, I'm going to help you and everything, but don't you ever ask me to come up there and give a report or speak in front of people. I can't do it, Caesar. I just can't do it. So, okay, he kind of respected that, you know. And we went on, about 3-4 months into a strike. Then he called me off, off. He says, now Richard's going to give us a report of what he's doing with this. I thought I was going to jump out of socket. I just so scared, I can remember still, And I got up there and I couldn't, the words wouldn't come out. I was scared, man. It must have shown my face because it. Some people started laughing. Then I got to two sides. It was really. I couldn't. My thoughts left me. I didn't know where I was at. It was really awful feeling, I said, Caesar, I quit, He started, he didn't laugh because I knew I was really peed out, And he says, well, why? You didn't do so bad. It was okay. What you said. He said, no, it wasn't, Caesar. I'm so embarrassed. I don't want to see none of those people that were there last night. I just, I'm quitting. I'm going to quit, I meant it, No, and then he says, Let's go have a beer. I feel like having a beer. Let's go have a beer. Give me a beer or two. We started drinking. He said, look, there's nothing to it. There's nothing to it. You just gotta you're talking to friends, Don't forget they're friends, You can just, you can talk to me, right? You're talking to me, right? You know what you're telling, It's the same thing, The main thing is you're talking to more people, But it's the same thing, you were talking to me, I said, no, we don't, you convinced me to stay, I guess I really wasn't going to quit, but, I felt like it. And he said, don't you call. I said, no, I'm going to call you again, but, just to say a word or two so you could, and remember, but I'm going to tell you this time, because he would have told me, I would have been scared, but I would have been kind of prepared, And God, he almost lost me there, And, so anyway. But once you do it, I guess it's not like, I always get a little, just a little. But once I get up, once I reach a microphone, it's gone, it's gone. Then I start speaking. And the best thing is to know what you're talking about, I still make notes, I get those little cards, or just headings, so I could, so it will flow, because I don't want to start saying something it's got to flow, and it flows better. People, you make a better presentation. People understand you better, And then when it comes to questions and answers, then it's they can, people are also making their notes so they can ask you stuff. And so, it's just, I can do it now. I think, I'm not afraid anymore.
Good.
I'm not afraid.
Any of your children involved in the union?
All of them.
Yes.
Yeah, they're all.
Ten, right?
One not full time, Some are full time. My oldest son is a judge now. Fred's my oldest. My oldest got killed in this. And not our accent, but the oldest now, second to the oldest. He's a judge in the Bay Area, and he was involved for full time. He worked with a union for many years, and my daughter, Dorothy, her and her husband were involved. Susana was involved for many years. Rebecca and Lupita were involved, but not full time. Like in this last March, we had Rebecca was in charge of, no, she was in charge, she was helping with the food to feed all these people.
Coordinating.
So that's they come in and help and like that. Yeah, and they're all involved when they're helping. They have to involve. They're involved. And then the others from the second family, they're also they're
they're always speaking, you know, like Juanito speak in the Bay Area, they have to send their speaker. Camila does some speaking also, Maria does in Los Angeles, and, you know, Ricky used to do some also. So everybody's involved at one time. When we need help, they're there, you know. So it's a family affair, really. And so Cesar's children, they're all involved, I mean. Yeah.
How are you involved in getting La Paz to
the
headquarters here?
Oh, that's a good story. Yeah, we did that. We really. Are you okay? It was in 1970, I think it's. It got to a point, you know, when they, like during the time of the service center, or even when the union began, you know, Cesar used to give a lot of personal attention to everybody he could, you know. Everybody had to talk to Cesar because, you know, Cesar was it. But then the union started growing, you know, he didn't have that luxury anymore, you know. He couldn't personally attend everybody that came to help. Everybody wanted to talk to Cesar, you know. So, and he got to a point where he was really getting it like a little frustrated, I think, because, you know, he says, I can't be in the lane. He says, you know, and I know headquarters, I got to look for another place where it's not so accessible, you know, where it's, I got to be away from, you know, I can't do my work anymore, you know. They wouldn't let him, you know, or just like, oh, no, I want to talk to Cesar. You know, I want to talk to Cesar. Everyone wants to talk to Cesar. You know, so, no, I can help you. No, but, you know, they know I already talked to him about it, you know, so that kind of thing, you know, so. And so, yes, yeah, I got to get away. You know. I got to get a little, not too far away, but, you know, just that way where they can't, they have to come and drive, you know. They're going to think about twice coming really to see me, you know. Not that he didn't want it to, that he couldn't anymore, you know. That he didn't have the luxury anymore, you know. And so, anyway, we started looking, you know. And we put out the word that we wanted to move out. We thought maybe Fresno or Baker, some place, you know, a little away. And somebody that worked for the county here, Leroy Shedfield, was sister's assistant. He was running the Farm Worker Service Center, Leroy Shedfield. And he had a friend that was working for the county here in Bakersfield, a good friend of his. And he told him, "So you know what, Leroy, there's a place up there who used to be the county TB sanitarium. It's been empty for I don't know how many years, 6 years. They don't use it anymore since they control the TB thing. You know, they don't need it anymore. And it's up there, and they're going to put out for auction." I said, "Really? Yeah. Where is it?" And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Boy, that'd be perfect. You know, that'd be great. You know, it's not too far, far enough. You know, it's just perfect. You know, up in the mountains." And so we all got excited. He says, "But I hear that it's already greased somebody. The guy that owns the King Ranch right next to is going to get it for almost nothing. You know, it's already been like, you know, he's going to get it. It's kind of hush hush, but they're going to, you know, they know what he's going to come in at, you know. But it's a public." "Yeah, well, it's going to be public." And I said, "But, you know, and like it's no doubt he's going to get it. You know, so there's nobody else going to compete that much." And so it's like, God, but we didn't have the means to, we still didn't have the means to, you know, get something like this, you know. But then we had a friend, Howard Lewis, I think it was, a movie producer at Bakersfield. He was one of our supporters. He used to come to La Paz on the caravans and all that. And yeah, I think he was well off, you know. And he said, "Look, Cesar, whenever I can do something for you," he said, "monetarily," he says, "you know, financially, I'd like to help somewhere, you know, whenever, you know." And so we thought about Lewis, you know, and we called him, and he came, we had a meeting, said, "Listen, this is happening. You know, if you could, you know, bid for us and lend us the money to, you know, the down payment, we get it, you know, they're asking so much, 10% after we get it, it's going to have to put down 10%, you know, and then payments and so forth." So he said, "Yeah, sure, Cesar, I'll do that, you know." So we came, he said, "But we can't see it, we go out there, they won't let us see it, you know, they wouldn't let us see it, you know." So he said, "Why don't you go out there?" He said, "I want to see what it's like, I want to see what's there, you know." And he says, "Well, Lewis said, you know, well, I can go see it, but I don't know much about buildings, and, you know, I don't know much about that." He says, "Well, my brother Richard's a builder, he knows a lot, but, you know, we'd be afraid if he goes out there, they would recognize him." No one said, "Hey, I need a chauffeur, you know. I need a chauffeur to drive my Lincoln Continental." He says, "You know, Richard could be my chauffeur, you know, get a Nakachidira chauffeur. I got some tea timers, you know, that came and they were showing Mr. Lewis and I was taking it all in, you know, making notes, I couldn't lie, you know. And so they showed it to me, really, you know. So they were just, this is Mr. Lewis and this and that. They showed him the whole thing. And I made mental pictures and also I took some notes and I went back to say this and this and this is what say, you know, and this is, I explained everything it was. It's, oh, that's great, Richard. And so bidding time comes, you know, and they didn't know. This guy was, like I said, you know, bidding started. And this guy, there was a few guys that started bidding and they dropped off right away, about 80,000, 90,000. This guy, we understand, was supposed to take it at 100,000. Okay. And so then suddenly this guy from Hollywood came in, this Luas, you know, was, this is, and then when he got to 100,000, you know, when he got to 100,000, 105, you know. And then nobody was supposed to. He was supposed to stop at that. And then guys, it was 110, 120, you know. And this guy, his plan is not, he's out of plan now, you know. He just doesn't know what's happening, you know. And 125, and then Nuda's going to 130, you know. He was determined to get it, you know. And he, at 130, the guy went out of socket. He just didn't know what he's going once, going twice, going three times, Mr. Lewis, 130,000 for 200 acres up here in the mountains. And that thing is worth $3-4 million now. Yeah. 71, 70. And he got it, you know. Okay, this is fine. Mr. Lewis got it, you know. And after he gets the papers and everything, he turns around and makes it public that it's for the EFW. And they wouldn't take our money. For many years, they wouldn't take our money. They just wouldn't accept our money. And then the lawyer said, that's okay, just put it in escrow. Just every month make the deposit to the bank. Like you were paying to them, just make it. Finally, about after 3 years, he said, well, these guys are going to stay, I guess. And so they said, okay, you'll get the money. We said, so at their own game, we beat them. You know. We beat them at their own game. And then when they found out, because the guy, they took some pictures from Lewis. They were showing us a person. They took a picture of Mr. Lewis. I was in the background. They blew it up, Caesar's brother. They told the whole story of what had happened, you know. He says, yeah, they were shown to Mr. Lewis, but they never asked him. We thought you were, they said you were his chauffeur. Yeah, that day I was his chauffeur, you know. And then we beat up their own game. That was a beautiful thing.
And now, have you ever had any problems with the neighbors?
Well, at first it was kind of cold. Yeah, no, you can see now. Everybody's on this. We're accepted in the community. We're accepted in the community now. Yeah, in Cotro Cabrón, it's always some. Yeah, but most of the guys are pretty decent. Yeah.
So who began to live in La Paz before starting?
The first family that moved up here were the Murguias, Lupe and Kathy Murguia and their family. They were the first ones that moved here. Sort of a caretaker to take care of the place. Murguia, Lupe and Kathy Murguia. I was in early 71. And then Caesar didn't move until 72, you know. And then other people started coming in after it.
Was there a school set up at La Paz?
Oh, yeah, we had a school. We always had a school for the kids, you know.
Oh, right there?
Yeah.
Who came up with the name La Paz?
Sister.
And why? Because
it's a place of peace, and it's a peaceful place, La Paz. You know? Peaceful place. Which it is, you know.
And I've been to the cafeteria. I heard that you constructed that.
Oh, yes. Yes. I remodeled the whole thing. In fact, I remodeled a lot of La Paz.
You remodeled
everything. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm a builder, but that's my profession. I'm a builder. Yeah. Well, I was until about 4 months ago, I retired. Now I'm a golfer.
Did you ever live in La Paz?
Oh, yes, many years.